An Ohio law that bans gender-affirming care for transgender minors and prohibits transgender girls from playing on female sports teams was about to go into effect next week, but a Franklin County judge granted a temporary pause after a challenge. Welcome to the Sound of Ideas Reporters Roundtable. I'm Marlene Harris-Taylor, in for Mike McIntyre. We'll discuss what comes next for the law and what will happen next with ongoing efforts by Democrats to ensure President Biden is on the Ohio ballot this November. Plus, ready for the orange barrels as ODOT unveils plans for more than 900 road and bridge projects. And a Cleveland council member is offering up a sweet deal to get people to remove cash for houses signs. The roundtable begins after news. It's the Sound of Ideas Reporters Roundtable from IdeaStream Public Media. I'm Marlene Harris-Taylor, in for Mike McIntyre. Thanks for joining us. The state's controversial bill to ban gender-affirming care for minors and ban transgender girls and women from competing in girls and women's scholastic sports has been paused by a judge for at least 2 weeks. The ACLU says the law violates the Ohio Constitution. But proponents say they're trying to protect children. There's drama in Columbus over whether President Joe Biden will be on the Ohio ballot this November, although some Republicans say the Biden campaign made an unforced error by possibly missing the ballot deadline. The top Republican in the Ohio Senate says the issue will be resolved. A Cleveland council member is offering a sweet deal to people to help tear down, you know, those signs you see everywhere, cash for houses. And no matter what highway or state route you use, get ready for the orange barrels. Joining me to talk about those stories and more from IdeaStream Public Media, government reporter Abby Marshall. Hey, Abby.
Hey, Marlene. Happy Taylor Swift album drop day.
All right. Abby is really excited. We're going to talk about that later. Also here with us is IdeaStream's education reporter, Connor Morris. Hey, Connor.
Hey, I'm just going to say happy Friday. I'm not a Taylor Swift listener. Sorry.
It's okay. You're forgiven. You are forgiven. And in Columbus, we have Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau Chief Karen Kassler. Hey, Karen.
Hey, happy Guardians weekend.
All right. Yeah, let's go. Yes. Now, we don't take calls on the roundtable, but please feel free to jump in and share your thoughts. Ask a question via email, soi@ideastream.org, or you can tweet X at Sound of Ideas. So let's get started. So, Karen, that decision by the Franklin County judge to temporarily block a ban on gender-affirming care for minors came after the American Civil Liberties Union, or ACLU, filed a lawsuit. So how long will this pause last for House Bill 68?
Well, we know that the pause will go for at least 14 days. Both sides in this case, the ACLU of Ohio and Republican Attorney General Dave Yost, who defends all laws that are passed by the legislature and signed by the governor, they both say that they're going to continue the litigation. The ACLU is hoping for a permanent injunction, meaning that it won't go into effect. It seems, though, in looking at some other laws that have been litigated like this, it could be quite a while before this one would go into effect if it does, because it seems like it's going to move its way up through the court system and possibly end up at the Ohio Supreme Court.
There's going to be a lot of back and forth there. So what is Yost's argument against pausing the law?
Well, he's defending the law that, you might remember, the legislature passed this law and Governor Mike DeWine vetoed it. Mm-hmm. And then the legislature came back and overrode his veto.
Yes.
And the argument on this has been that girls and women need to be protected, and that the concerns about the health of trans girls and trans minors in general is a problem. So the law does two things. It bans gender transition treatment for minors, and it also bans trans girls from competing in girls' sports at the high school level and at the college level. And so the argument has been that this protects girls, it protects kids. The other side, of course, the ACLU has said, and that's what they said in this lawsuit, which was filed on behalf of two 12-year-old trans girls, one from Hamilton County and one from Columbus, Franklin County, they said that this law blocks their access to needed medical care. And the judge apparently, at least temporarily, said that he agreed with the he found the ACLU's arguments more persuasive. So there's still a lot more to come here.
Okay. So when DeWine originally vetoed this, he said he had heard from a lot of parents, right, about some mental health concerns.
Yeah, I think it was a bit of a surprise to some folks when he did veto this, but he said he had talked to people on both sides, the people who supported this law and the people who were concerned about it, and he was swayed by the arguments of parents of trans kids who are concerned about their child's access to this treatment and also concerned about their child's access to be able to play sports. And so this has been a long process. This bill was not just suddenly put together last year. It's been working its way through the litigation process for quite a while. And now you've got this legal process underway, but also DeWine has proposed some administrative rules where the state and state agencies will make some will oversee the transition, gender transition treatment that's already out there and collect some data on that. And so that's going on, even though there is a pause on this law.
You know, it's interesting. Sometimes in the state, we want parents' rights and parents to have the final say on certain issues. And then other issues, it's like, no, we don't want the parents to have the final say.
And that's been an argument here, is that, you know, if you want parents' rights, where do parents' rights start or end? Because parents have said that they want, the parents of trans kids have said they want the rights to be able to continue their kids' gender transition treatment, that it's medically important and necessary, and they've been in consultation with doctors. But then you also have the parents' rights concerns about, you know, books and vaccines and all this other stuff. So it's an interesting argument.
Mm-hmm. Now, there's one thing that the ACLU is arguing is kind of wonky, but they're arguing around this single subject rule. Can you explain that for us?
This is an argument that comes up in a lot of litigation, and it's in other litigation that's going on right now, I believe, over school vouchers. I have yet to see this really be a successful strategy over time, and okay. I've asked a couple of political science and legal professors about this, and they've agreed with me. It's basically that every piece of legislation is supposed to have a single subject, a single topic that it deals with. The budget is kind of a different thing because the budget brings together a lot of different financial things and policy things. But the single subject rule has been cited quite often. And like I said, I just have not seen that be successful.
So everybody tries it.
Yeah, well, it is. I mean, certainly you look at it and it doesn't seem to make a whole lot of sense why some legislation seems to have all these other different things attached to it. But there usually is some small thread that connects this thing that to this seemingly unrelated thing. And again, the courts have not yet, to my recollection, shown that a particular law violated the single subject rule, and that's why that law could not go into effect.
And as you said, this is probably going to be working its way through the courts for quite a while.
Oh, yeah. I mean, and when you look at, for example, legislation on abortion, this is exactly the kind of process where it goes to court. There is an ask for a temporary restraining order or a stop or an injunction or something, and then the law keeps working its way through the courts. I mean, the 6-week abortion ban that Ohio had in place before, well, it was in 2019 that it was passed, and that law has really gone into effect only very briefly right after the U.S. Supreme Court decided the Dobbs decision, which allowed states to regulate abortion. And, I mean, 2019, it's been going on for a while.
So, Karen, the Democrats are also still trying to ensure that President Joe Biden will appear on the November general election ballot in Ohio. This week, though, Ohio Senate President Matt Huffman said he believes Democrats will figure out how to resolve the issue. So, Karen, I'm just wondering, how did we get here with a possible presidential candidate not being on the Ohio ballot?
Well, Huffman said something kind of interesting in talking to reporters about this, in explaining why Ohio has a 90-day deadline for its presidential candidate certification. And he said it's because Ohio has 30 days of early voting, so the deadline for presidential candidates to be certified for the fall ballot needs to be pushed back 90 days was the agreed upon date in a bill in 2010. And a lot of it has to do with overseas ballots and military ballots. They have to get out to those voters before the early voting period starts so that they have the full early voting period. So this law, unfortunately, 90 days is a long time. I mean, that pushes the deadline back into early August. And a lot of times these conventions are held in late August, even early September. And that's what happened in 2012. It happened in 2020 when both parties nominating conventions were held after that 90-day deadline that was passed in 2010. And both times, the legislature put a 60-day fix on it, moved the deadline from 90 days to 60 days. Now we're in a situation where only the Democratic convention is affected. The Republican convention is before the deadline. And Secretary of State Frank LaRose notified Democrats saying, you folks are going to miss the deadline unless something happens by May 9th from the legislature or unless the convention is moved. And so that's where we are right now, is trying to figure out exactly what's going to happen.
Yeah, because the Democratic convention is currently scheduled for August 19th, which is after that deadline, right?
Yeah, and the idea that it's going to be moved, I mean, you know, it's been in place for over a year.
Yeah.
And other states have wrestled with this as well. Alabama, for instance, Alabama's working it out. Ohio isn't the only one here, but Ohio has not yet come up with a solution. Now, Huffman says he wants to accommodate. He's going to try to accommodate whatever Democrats come up with. And the Biden campaign has pointed out that other states have worked this out, and they say Biden is going to be on the ballot in all 50 states.
So do you think we see another potential lawsuit coming here?
We can't have an election in Ohio without a lawsuit, but I don't know if it's going to be over this or not. I mean, it is, Huffman pointed out that there was just an argument before the U.S. Supreme Court about how Colorado tried to keep Donald Trump off the ballot there. Different issues involved here, but still the idea of a presidential candidate from a major political party not appearing on the ballot because a state decided that he or she should not appear on the ballot, that's kind of extraordinary. And so he believes the federal court would step in if Ohio doesn't make a change. The question is, of course, what's the change going to be? Are legislators going to move that deadline back to 60 days? They have to do that by May 9th, and it is April 19th right now, so not a lot of time to make that happen. Or there could be other things that go on at the Democratic level. The Biden campaign says state officials have the ability to accept a provisional nomination and allow provisional ballot access. And maybe that's the way that this goes. Don't know.
Well, we'll have to see how that one works out as well. Thanks, Karen. We're going to move on to talk about a Cleveland issue. Cleveland Mayor Justin Bibbs' lakefront master plan is still being put together by an architecture firm. But that process is already over budget. Council this week expressed its dissatisfaction after the administration sought approval to pay additional costs above the $500,000 already approved. Mm-hmm. So, Abby, again, how did we get here?
Yeah, so the original contract was approved for $500,000 to design that plan, and now the city is coming back and asking for an additional $400,000, which $260,000 of which has already been billed. That work has already been done. And so the chief financial officer for the city says this was not something we expected to happen. We just started getting invoices and now, you know, they're coming to get their money. So the city can't disperse any funds without council approval, which is why they needed to come back and ask for that money. But obviously that is a huge overspend as compared to the original budget. So council members were not thrilled with that.
Huge overspend, absolutely. So some people may wonder, what exactly is this contractor doing? You know, mm-hmm. So we often hear about consultants, contractors.
Sure.
What are they actually tasked to do?
Well, this is going to be a massive project in downtown Cleveland. We're talking about a complete redesign of the way that Clevelanders interact downtown with our waterfronts, not just the riverfront, but the lakefront as well. So that is going to include things like viewing vistas, a beach downtown, a pedestrian bridge. We're talking decades and billions of dollars. So this is a design game plan. You know, we've had lakefront plans that have been scrapped and drawn up for decades and decades. But Mayor
many,
Bibb.
Many, many times.
Oh, yes. So that's that's what I hear. And so this is one that Mayor Bibb is determined to see through. So mm-hmm. he wants to make sure that this is the most comprehensive and well-designed plan as possible. So that is what this is aiming to do.
I mean, the plans look really cool. Mm-hmm. It would be really fantastic if it happens.
Right.
But council is saying, well, hold up. You know, this is going to set a bad precedent,
uh-huh.
right? If we let you just go ahead and let somebody overrun the approved budget.
Right. Yeah. And that's how contracts work at the city, basically. The city puts out what's called a RFP, a request for proposal and request for bids. And basically, companies put in their bids, and based on a vetting process, basically, a main factor of it is who is going to be the cheapest, because taxpayers are funding that. So some council members said, well, if these contractors come to us and say, this is what our budget is, this is how much it's going to cost, and then they come back and change their minds and say, actually, it's going to cost this much, they're saying there could be an issue in the future where they could be lowballed. And then, you know, they've already been doing the work that now the city has to pay for.
Right. Everybody could just do that. Say, oh, I'm going to do it for this amount and then really bill higher.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Yeah.
So you don't see council really pulling the rug from under the mayor and pulling the rug from this project, do you?
You know, they held it for discussion. Like I said, that $260,000 that work has already been done. So we're talking the $500,000 plus the $260,000. That work has been done. However, the city has not paid any of that $260,000 and cannot until council approves it. The CFO for the city, the finance director, says that, you know, according to state law, if a contractor goes over the budgeted amount, they kind of do so at their own risk if the city decides not to pay them. It's just a matter of will they or won't they? So council has held that for future discussion. And I think that the main sticking point here is, like you said, setting a bad precedent.
So the contractor theoretically could get stuck holding the bag.
That is what the finance director seemed to indicate in the committee meeting. Yes.
Okay. So more to come. They're going to continue working through this
mm-hmm.
at City Council. Okay. Let's move to Kent State, because there was a really interesting event there, Connor, this week. Kent State University students protested this week over a speaking engagement at the campus by Kyle Rittenhouse. And a lot of people probably know that name, remember that name. A jury acquitted Rittenhouse of charges in the shooting deaths of two Black Lives Matter protesters in Wisconsin in 2020. Rittenhouse claimed self-defense in the shooting. The Kent State chapter of Turning Point USA invited Rittenhouse to the campus. So Connor, how many protesters were there, you know, really, you know, protesting this thing? It was really built up, but what really yeah. happened?
Yeah, so there was a walkout earlier in the day, and then, you know, some student organizations had a bit of a press conference, so to speak, talking about their opposition to him even being on campus. After the event, there were probably about 200 to 300 folks outside. They were booing the folks that had attended the talk as they left. There were a good amount of folks in the audience as well, too. There were about maybe 200 folks or so. It was an interesting kind of mix.
Would you describe it as a packed meeting?
It was pretty full. Yeah, it was. You know, most of the seats were full. You know, the majority of folks in the audience were in support of Rittenhouse. It was an interesting mix of or some older folks, folks were 50 plus who had showed up from out of town and in town as well. There were young folks as well in Trump hats. But there were folks that came there that were not applauding, who were just there to listen to as well. So it was an interesting mm-hmm. kind of atmosphere.
So what is Turning Point USA, and what was the focus of his remarks?
Yeah, so Turning Point USA is a youth-focused political action nonprofit that promotes conservative causes at schools and at colleges and universities as well. And it does platform some far-right figures, too, as well. They've got a chapter on a lot of campuses, including at Kent State. And they brought Rittenhouse there to talk about the Second Amendment. And so he spent a lot of his time kind of rehashing the events in Kenosha, Wisconsin, when he said that he was attacked by protesters and harried and only opened fire on people after he was there. And there is video and you know, a lot of evidence in the trial that did back up that yeah, he was hit in the head with a skateboard. People were chasing him. And so he was making the case kind of again that he was defending himself, you know, and that he came there to provide first aid, and folks were applauding that in the audience. Some folks were agreeing with them. They were saying, you did the right thing. You were defending, you know, yourself, and, you know, you're using, you know, we have the Second Amendment for a reason, and that's why. But the protesters, I mean, there was one hard question he got from somebody who, you know, was not a fan, and saying, why did you go there in the first place? If you're providing first aid, why did you have an assault rifle? Why were you riling up the crowd? You know, like, mm-hmm. why were people, you know, trying to attack you? So
that's a good question. You know, we've seen this on college campuses across the country. This, you know, a controversial figure comes in, yeah. and there's protests from students. And, you know, in the past few years, we've seen where some colleges will cancel the event. Yeah. But Kent State said, no, we're going to go ahead and have this event. But what was the mood on campus? Like, of course, we had the protesters. But yeah. did it resonate across the campus, do you think?
There were, you know, even the protesters, they were not like, and it wasn't really an angry group, so to speak. I mean, they were booing, yes, and they had signs that said, you know, Crybaby Kyle, you know, they weren't necessarily that civil, but it was kind of almost a celebratory environment too. Mm. There was a guy in like a Scooby Doo costume. There was a guy in a suit of medieval armor.
Scooby Doo. What was the point?
Yeah,
Scooby Doo.
I don't know exactly. I didn't get a chance to talk to him, but there were also folks in the crowd having some discussions too about the Second Amendment and the First Amendment.
Okay.
So there was some discourse going on, actually.
Some real exchanges going.
Yeah,
on.
And, okay. and you know, I've covered college protests on college campuses for, you know, a while now. I mean, almost I've been a reporter for 10 years. Wow. Back at Ohio University, where Abby and I are both, you know, alums of, you know, we would often see protests, you mm-hmm. know, and usually it was, you know, nobody was ever really shouted down. You know, you do see on some college campuses, like you mentioned, yeah, people will cancel the events in expectation of a big, you know, protest that might, you know, disrupt the flow of traffic or might cause unlawful behavior. Some schools make the decision not to. Kent State was like, no, we're not going to cancel any talks. We're all about the First Amendment here. That's what colleges are meant to be, or universities are meant to be, is a forum for free expression. So.
Yeah. And did the university, did they put out any kind of statements or anything around this?
Yeah, they did.
And what did they say?
That was exactly what they said, that, you know, we're trying to be a bastion of the free speech here and trying to really be a forum. We can't cancel a talk like this just because, you know, folks might disagree with it. So
now, you know, and some people hearken back to, you know, the infamous event at Kent State,
sure.
the shooting, some students getting killed.
Yeah.
And some people who were criticizing the event said, yeah. hey, you know, like, this might remind people of this. I'm not sure. The connection there, what do you think?
Yeah, we ran into somebody who went to KSU when the shootings happened. So there, she was attending, you know, at the time. And
Because May 4th is the anniversary,
yeah,
right?
So it's coming up
very close to the anniversary, and that's sort of why some people were saying maybe this is inappropriate to have this.
That's
at
exactly
that
what she said. Yeah, she was saying, you know, she said she understood freedom of speech, but she also said, look, it's kind of a bad look to have somebody who killed two people, you know, with a gun, you know, on campus around the same time period. It's still kind of raw for some people, you know. So,
but overall, sounds like it was pretty civil. The yeah. event went on, and life has gone on at Kent State.
Oh, yeah.
That.
He was able to say, you know, what he wanted to say. He did post on his Twitter account that Antifa was here. This is their reaction to me uh-huh. at campus. It was a video of him leaving the talk as people were kind of booing him. But it was a small crowd by that point. It was a much larger crowd before. You know,
so it sounds like he took advantage of the event to kind of build up his reputation a little bit.
Yeah. He's really used the notoriety that he's gained, you know, to kind of further his platform. He's got a video game he's working on. It's a turkey hunting video game
okay.
where the turkeys are meant to represent members of the media.
Oh,
so that's interesting.
Okay.
So he's kind of made this transition to this kind of,
that's not,
some would argue, a far right figure at this point.
Okay. Well, on that note, I think it's time for us to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll talk about the many construction projects headed to a highway near you. This is the Sound of Ideas Reporters Roundtable. I'm Marlene Harris-Taylor in for Mike McIntyre, and we'll be right back. You're with the Sound of Ideas Reporters Roundtable from IdeaStream Public Media. I'm Marlene Harris-Taylor in for Mike McIntyre. I'm joined this week by Abby Marshall and Connor Morris from IdeaStream Public Media and State House News Bureau Chief Karen Kassler. Before we get back to the roundtable, here's a reminder you can test your knowledge of the week's news by taking the IdeaStream News Quiz. You can find it at ideastream.org/quiz. Or to get a head start, finish listening to the roundtable, and then you take the quiz. Abby, have you taken the quiz?
I have not taken this week's quiz, no.
Abby, have you taken the quiz?
Oh, yeah.
It's kind of fun,
it's a good
huh?
Time.
Connor, have you taken it?
I have not yet, actually. Okay, Connor. So I got to admit, I am not like a news quiz kind of guy. Like, I don't do the Wordle or anything like that. Like, also, I sounded like I was like 70 years old. I don't do the Wordle.
That Wordle thing. It's all right, Connor. We forgive you. It's not
a good brand ambassador.
Nah. It's not for you. It's not for everybody. But if you are the kind of person who loves this kind of thing, you can go to ideastream.org/quiz. Also, if you drive anywhere in Northeast Ohio, road construction is likely coming your way. The Ohio Department of Transportation announced more than 900 road and bridge projects for this construction season, including pavement replacement on I-90 in Cleveland, Lakewood, and Rocky River in Cuyahoga County, widening Interstate 77 in Bath and Richfield Township in Summit County, and construction of more construction of State Route 21 in Wayne County. So, Karen, are these new projects or ongoing ones? Is it a mix?
Well, the state overall has focused a lot on repairing and revamping and improving existing infrastructure rather than building these huge projects. There are those, and some of those are still in process. Here in Columbus, for instance, where 70 and 71 come together, there's been this years-long process to try to separate those and clean that up so that you don't have two freeways crossing each other right in the middle of a downtown area. And that'll extend out until the 2030s, from what I understand at this point. But according to ODOT, 93 cents of every dollar they bring in for road construction and improvement, which is gas tax revenue, mm-hmm. is going to the maintenance of stuff that's already on the roads, and bridges, paving, doing other projects that really try to improve what's already there.
I mean, it's so important. You know, we definitely want smooth roads, and especially these bridge projects. We want to make sure these bridges are shored up. But it's such a pain, Karen, dealing with all these orange barrels everywhere.
Yeah, but it's worse when the bridge completely disappears. I will say that.
Great point.
885 bridges across the state are either going to be repaired or replaced. And one of those replaced bridges, I think, is in Summit County, State Route 8. So there's a lot of stuff going on. This is the season when it gets done because, you know, you can't. It's hard to do road construction in the wintertime when you have no idea what the weather's going to be like. But one of the things that ODOT has talked about is that there are 950 road and bridge projects, $2.8 billion this year. There are 39 major projects costing over $10 million each. And also there are 176 safety projects, and those are specifically looking at some of the data that ODOT has collected about where are the most dangerous places in Ohio for drivers. And another thing that they're talking about in terms of safety is 43 accidents so far this year, crashes involving ODOT workers, snow plows, people in construction zones. So that's compared to 56 in all of last year, 43 already this year. So the idea of slowing down and following the signs when you get to a road construction site is or when the lanes start to narrow or whatever is really important.
Yeah, you got to slow down. Now, there's times that I'm on the turnpike and it's a nice clear day, you know, and I'm kind of going along, you don't see anybody in those construction zones. You know, you're tempted to not slow down and brake, but you really got to do it because, you know, the fines are doubled, right?
In a lot of work zones, yes. And it's certainly, we've had some terrible accidents in Northeast Ohio and around the state over the years of crew members getting hit in those work zones. And these are terrible situations, and It's completely unnecessary in the sense that these are marked.
Yes.
You should see the sign coming. Oh, they warn you.
Yeah, they give you plenty of warning. A huge price tag you mentioned there, Karen. So where's the money coming from? Is it all state funding? Is some federal money coming into this?
Well, this is the gas tax money that funds primarily road construction and infrastructure projects. I mean, there's certainly federal funding coming from the infrastructure bill. I mean, you've heard about the big bridge down in Cincinnati that's being completely reconstructed. Mm-hmm. That's with federal funds. But these projects, these 950 projects that the state is talking about that you just outlined, really is gas tax revenue. That's a continuing concern, though, because as cars become more fuel efficient and we have more hybrid cars, more electric cars, then gas tax revenue has been dropping. The gas tax was increased in 2019, but there's a concern over time of how sustainable that is when the cost of construction are not going down.
Good point. I guess the state's going to have to start thinking about another source of revenue. But listen, we know that they'll always figure out another way to tax us. Right, Karen?
Well, and in some states, there have been some interesting proposals. I mean, talking about people who the big semi truck drivers, those folks paying a little bit more than a smaller car owner might pay because there's more damage from a big semi truck than there is a small car. But of course, that runs into some serious problems, too. So this is an issue that really needs a lot of discussion, I think.
Mm-hmm. We might see more like pay for riding on a road and stuff like that. But Karen, I guess it's inevitable. Like you said, it's the summertime. We got to get ready for the orange barrels. So, Abby, a Cleveland council member has come up with a unique way to get people to remove cash for houses signs in the city. Ice cream?
Yes.
Yeah. So Chris Harsh, he represents Ward 13 in Old Brooklyn, the Old Brooklyn neighborhood. So how's ice cream going to get rid of signs?
Well, his point is that these signs pop up, you know, pretty regularly, but in the spring, there's always a new crop of them. You see them everywhere. You see them, you know, on city property, telephone poles, that sort of thing. And that's actually illegal.
Is it?
Addition to his claims, which we'll get into a little bit about these signs being predatory on particularly neighborhoods that are impoverished.
You tend to see more of them.
Yes.
In under-resourced neighborhoods.
Correct. Okay. And I can explain why a little bit, but his point was, you know, it's the springtime. Ice cream shops are opening up, so I might as well put a bounty on these signs, and whoever collects the most, he's asking people to take pictures of their pile, tell him how many they've collected. He will buy them Honey Hut ice cream.
All right. So, sweet deal, as we said, right?
Correct, yeah.
So let's talk about these signs. Mm-hmm. You mentioned that there's often more in under-resourced neighborhoods.
Correct.
Why is that?
Yeah, the idea is that you are targeting people who may not have the capacity or the finances to take on large maintenance projects on homes that are, you know, maybe in a poor state, or you're talking about a family member that has maybe passed away and people are just trying to rid themselves of this home, that sort of thing, or people that just need cash really quickly. And oftentimes Harsh was saying that these people that are buying up these houses in bulk are flipping them and then selling them often to out-of-state landlords and investors, which is something that, you know, I've reported on a lot as we talk about residents first legislation and ways that the city is trying to hold these out-of-state landlords accountable and people that are letting this housing stock continue to decay. So the idea is that, you know, if we put up a sign, hey, get some money quick, and if someone is really strapped for cash and needs that, they might sell a property that could help with generational wealth or something in the future like that.
So has there been any reaction that we know of to the people behind the signs, the people who put them up, to this offer for people to get ice cream if they take the signs down?
So the sign that Harsh put up in his social media video encouraging people to take these down, I did call that phone number. I haven't received a response, but that's not a surprise. As I've done a lot of housing reporting on people or landlords or organizations that have been criticized as being predatory on under-resourced neighborhoods and things like that, they tend to not respond. They're hard to get in touch with. I guess unless you're trying to sell your house, then
right.
Maybe they will be very responsive.
Yeah. Well, yeah, how do they answer the phone when you're trying to sell your house?
Hey, it's me, Abby Marshall from IdeaStream.
You have to be ethical and identify
Correct.
Yourself as
yes.
a reporter.
Right.
So this is actually, it's an interesting you know, creative idea. And as you said, it's illegal to, for them to post them in a lot of places that you see them anyway.
Right, right. You can't, you know, run around and pull signs out of people's yards or whatever. But as Harsh said, he may be willing to turn a blind eye when someone's missing a pet or something and post it on a telephone pole, things like that.
Right.
But if it's something that he views as, you know, damaging his neighborhood or other Cleveland neighborhoods, he's like, you know, there has to be some amount of accountability. And so just rip him on down.
Okay. Well, we'll see if people take him up on that offer.
Yeah.
I wouldn't mind having some Honey Hut ice cream.
I know.
I hear it's really good.
I actually haven't been yet, but.
Okay. That's what I hear. So, Connor, a Lakewood-based college announced this week it's shutting its doors. It's just the latest college in the region to do so. North Coast College says it will close on August 30th. So how many students, Connor, will be impacted by this?
Yeah, it's a pretty small private for-profit college. So it's a little bit different than, you know, our colleges and other colleges and universities we've been talking about lately. But, you know, about 45 students or so in 2021, they used to have 150 to 200 students per year. So that seems
small,
to suggest
yeah.
that there's, you know, been a decline too as well. Yeah, I mean, colleges, especially the smaller private colleges and universities, are especially struggling with this enrollment decline that universities and colleges have been seeing since, you know, for more than a decade now. There's been a long-term trend downward as costs of college continue to rise, and there's also a declining birth rate, so there's just fewer and fewer students who are, you know, kind of available for these colleges to try to snap up to as well. So
I also see a lot of people, particularly on social media, who are questioning the value of higher education now. What's the return on investment is sort of the phrase.
Yeah. Surveys show that, Americans' faith in the value of a college education has steadily declined for, you know, probably the last three decades or more. And some of it has to do with cost. Some of it has to do, too, with messaging, how worth it is an English degree, for example, you know.
Liberal arts degrees in particular are sort of targeted in these conversations.
Yes, yes, as well. And it's become kind of a cultural issue, too, as well, in that regard, too, you know. So,
but bigger schools are facing this. I mean, this is a small school.
Yeah.
But bigger schools are facing this, too, right? And Cleveland State University is really in trouble right now financially. Right.
Yeah. They've got a $40 million budget deficit, and that's, you know, relatively sizable based on their budget. They the trustees just approved like $9 million to offer early retirement incentives to faculty and staff who've been there for a while. And so the idea is they're trying to right size the district, quote unquote. They're trying to kind of decrease their budget overall so that it's not as big of a deal, you know, if maybe they see less students than they would anticipate, you know, moving forward. So
I mean, it makes sense logically. If there's fewer students, you don't have enough students to matriculate into all of these colleges. So people could argue that we're really just right-sizing higher education overall. I'm sure you've heard that argument.
Yes, yeah, exactly. And, you know, we're even seeing it too, you know, with, so like I mentioned, with these private colleges. So Notre Dame College, of course, just a couple months ago in South Euclid said they'd be closing outright. And, you know, there were discussions about maybe Cleveland State absorbing them initially. So one thing that we could be seeing as some of these other colleges close is that those students will go to other colleges, and that will help shore up their budgets kind of long term. That's something that we'll be looking into down the road.
Okay. So it's a trend that we'll probably see happening across our area, across the state, and across
the
country. The
country,
really.
Yeah. Absolutely.
So, Karen, I'm going to come back to you because supporters of a bipartisan bill to protect survivors of domestic violence are trying for a third time to get the legislation passed. State Representative Juanita Brent of Cleveland, a Democrat, and Sarah Carruthers of Hamilton, a Republican, have reintroduced Aisha's Law. Can you give us some background on that bill, Karen?
Well, Aisha's Law is named for Aisha Frazier, who was stabbed to death by her ex-husband, Lance Mason, a former Democratic state lawmaker and judge, in 2018. He has been sentenced to prison for life for that. And what's important about that story, besides the terrible tragedy here and the loss of somebody who was, community-wide seen as a great teacher and a great person is that Lance Mason had actually been locked up before for assaulting his ex-wife. And so this law hopes to get some training for law enforcement who respond to domestic violence situations to try to help them identify situations where the person who is being assaulted is in real danger and that could be hurt, very seriously hurt, or even killed. And so the law requires officers who handle those domestic violence complaints to learn intervention techniques, requires courts to have somebody available 24 hours a day, 7 days a week to accept domestic violence protection order petitions, expands the offense of child endangering to include the offense of domestic violence when a child is present, and it also expands the offense of aggravated murder. The one thing that this time it doesn't do is previous versions have added strangulation as a felony. Ohio is the last state in the country where strangulation was a misdemeanor. Now it is a felony because of a law that was signed last year. So that's the only difference here.
I'm so glad to hear that. You know, I think people don't recognize, Karen, how these domestic violence situations tend to build on each other. You know, as you mentioned, he was, incarcerated or put in jail before. How it tends to be like a cycle that builds. And I don't think people realize how often guns are involved in these domestic violence situations.
Absolutely. We had two police officers who were shot and killed in outside of Columbus in Westerville, where they had been responding to a domestic violence situation. I mean, these are dangerous situations because of everything that's involved here. And so to get officers a little bit more training is important. And also with Aisha's law, it's passed the Ohio House twice, I believe, and it hasn't moved in the Senate. And that's been the frustration here, is that if there's agreement that this training should happen and that these are significant concerns here, why hasn't it passed? Hmm. You have a third of the Ohio House now, Republicans and Democrats, who have signed on to this bill. So hopefully, at least for domestic violence advocates, they believe hopefully this will pass.
That's a great question. It seems to have strong support. So what is the holdup?
That's a good question. I think there's the issue of running out of time sometimes, which is an excuse we often hear. Well, we ran out of time because it's an election year or whatever. But there was one year where it was sponsored, where it was House Bill 3, which is a priority bill, considered something that was expected to pass, and it didn't. So still waiting to find out exactly what's going to happen this time.
Well, hopefully they can get things moving on that much-needed law. So, Abby, Akron Mayor Shamus Malik says the acting police chief Brian Harding is the sole finalist for the job. The mm-hmm. previous police chief stepped down earlier this year. So, Abby, the community will get a chance to ask questions of Harding in the coming days.
Yeah, so there will be two town halls for the community to meet him. I'll just plug that right now in case anyone's interested in going. Mm-hmm. April 20th at 10 at the Buchtel Community Learning Center. April 23rd at 6 at the East Community Learning Center. And this is really important when it comes to trust and trust building in that community with many people that were hurt or are skeptical of Akron police, given the events of two summers ago when Akron police killed Jalen Walker.
Yeah, so there's a lot of interest in the new police chief mm-hmm. coming in. So hopefully people will take advantage of that and go to these public hearings or public events, I should say, and then ask questions. Mm-hmm. So what are you hearing about this finalist?
So, you know, originally, as we've talked about, this was supposed to be a national search, which is how they found their previous police chief. But as we've discussed on the show, turns out that there is a state and city law that basically prevents Akron from hiring an external candidate.
Okay.
So a charter amendment would have to be drawn up and passed by voters in order to change that law. But Malik says, you know, that won't be necessary because he does not want to wait that long. Mm. And so they need to just proceed with this internal search. And so that has drawn criticism from some people in the community
yeah.
who wanted, you know, perhaps more diverse candidate or someone just not related to Akron police at all, again, given what
like
had happened.
Like the trust issue there.
Sure, sure. So, I mean, as it stands right now, it looks like Brian Harding will be assuming that role.
Looks like he's going to be the shoe-in. Mm-hmm. Unless something, you know, pops up in the next few days
right.
or weeks.
And I'm sure our Akron reporters, Ann Huntsman and Abigail Botar, will be on top of
it. They're going to stay on top of it as always.
Yes.
Okay, it's time for us to take another quick break. We got a few more stories that we'll talk about on the other side. This is the Sound of Ideas Reporters Roundtable. I'm Marlene Harris-Taylor in for Mike McIntyre, and we'll be right back. is the Sound of Ideas Reporters Roundtable from IdeaStream Public Media. I'm Marlene Harris-Taylor in for Mike McIntyre with Karen Kassler, Connor Morris, and Abby Marshall. So, Connor, the Akron Board of Education, one of the members said this week that they're concerned about the community trust in the district and the potential impact of the fall levy request. So, Connor, the district will seek the levy request this November, but has not set the amount yet.
Yeah, it's going to be a sizable amount, likely. It's going to be two parts. A smaller portion is going to go to renovate the new North High School, which is that's less controversial. I think quite a few folks in the community understand the need. There's mold, there's ceilings collapsing. It's not a great situation. And that's one of the parts of Akron that it has seen some growth with immigrant and refugee families moving to it, actually. So
a needed building there.
Yeah, for sure. And the more controversial part is operating funds. So and that'll be the larger part of the levy. And the district's weathered some controversies in recent years. Some folks have accused the board of pushing out the former superintendent, Christine Fowler Mack, kind of micromanaging her. There was also contentious negotiations between the teachers union and the district about a year ago, where teachers were, they were really concerned about violence in the schools, and that's a concern for some folks. But actually, the board member was saying that they think that the school district kind of rolled over too much, that they gave large raises to the teachers and that they don't necessarily deserve them.
But everybody says teachers don't get paid enough.
Yeah, yeah. And some of these larger school districts, the median pay for teachers is actually, it's maybe more than $50,000. So it's a bit higher than some might actually think. But they the folks that were concerned about this are saying that there was this controversy more recently this year where there was a $156,000 grant from the state to fund tutoring for students that were behind in reading, and the teachers union came out swinging against it. Mm-hmm. And so folks are saying this is free money that could have helped our kids, and you said no, basically, and the district ended up losing the grant because of it.
That's why they're concerned about the lack of trust there from the community.
Yeah, and there's just some concerns with the board's ability to lead, but also with the teachers themselves.
So do they have a plan to build up trust this levy?
That's the next step for them. And unfortunately, Ohio law actually limits how much boards and school districts can advocate for levies, too. They're really restricted to just providing the facts. So kind of puts them in a little bit of a tough spot. Mm-hmm. Many districts actually in a tough spot.
Well, maybe a community group will step in.
That's usually what they have to rely on their behalf. Yeah, is an advocacy group that kind of steps in and does some of that and raises some money to do some of that work. So we'll see.
Okay, we'll see what happens there. A plan to provide additional police and transportation efforts in the city's in Cleveland's University Circle neighborhood has been approved by Cleveland City Council. The neighborhood is home to some of the city's biggest employers and attractions, including Cleveland Clinic, University Hospital, and the Art and Natural History Museum. So, Abby, the plan calls for the creation of this special improvement district. Mm-hmm. So how does that work?
So basically, it's a geographic area where property owners basically pay into public improvements. And when you talk about University Circle specifically, they have a joint police agreement with the city of Cleveland. So they have a special police force over there. So the idea is, like you just mentioned, it has some of the biggest attractions, employers in the entire city. So there are 50,000 people that come in and out of that area every day. So the city says, they need the extra help and the extra bodies. And Cleveland is kind of strapped when it comes to officer resources. And so the idea is hopefully this will help CPD maybe focus on other parts of the city.
I see. So it'll free up some police officers. So this is also going to include money for bias-free training?
Yes. And that, again, when we talk about Cleveland, which is under a consent decree for policing, that seems to be something, again, toward building trust in the community and, working on bettering the police force, I suppose.
So is anybody upset about this? Everybody thinks this is a great idea.
I haven't heard much about, people being upset about it. So hopefully it's just a positive thing for that area and, has ripple effects in terms of getting officers perhaps in other parts of Cleveland as well.
Well, I know everybody in Cleveland is really proud of that district. It's an area we always point tourists to in the city. So it's great to see that there's going to be some improvements there. Right. So, Abby, I know that you're going to love this next story when we get to Taylor Swift soon, because Abby is a Taylor Swift fan. But first, we're going to talk about the coming Broadway season at Playhouse Square.
I can also talk about that.
You can talk about that, too? It's going to offer up, you know, quite a mix for theater fans. Playhouse Square announced the lineup earlier this week, and it includes jukebox musicals to stage adaptations of the movies to Tony Award winners. The Broadway series begins with A Beautiful Noise about the life and music of Neil Diamond. Are you a Neil Diamond fan too?
No, honestly, I don't love jukebox musicals, but there are some in this upcoming season that I am very excited about.
All right.
For sure.
And now, Abby, the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame is hosting a Taylor Swift Fan Day today, Friday. It's in anticipation of Swift's new album that's coming out today, The Tortured Poets Department. So let's hear a little bit of that.
Well,
best believe I'm still bejeweled. When I walk in the room, I can still make the whole place shimmer. And when I meet the band, they ask, do you have a man? I can still say I don't remember.
So, Abby, that's not from the new album.
No, it's not.
The song
it's
we're listening
song.
To. It's a great song.
We can still jam out to it. Yeah, so I will be at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame today covering that. And so keep an eye out for coverage, as we know. Taylor Swift's boyfriend is from Cleveland, Travis Kelce.
So do we expect him in town today?
I don't know, man. He seems to be everywhere. Who knows?
So what do you think? You think there's going to be a lot of Swifties out there?
Oh, absolutely. Especially, you know, Taylor Swift dropped a double album, actually. So we were anticipating 15 tracks, and we got another 15 at 2 a.m. So I will be over there, and I'm sure that they'll be pumped about that.
This is going to be a huge event. It's going to be a huge event in town and probably online as well.
Definitely.
People are going to be rocking out to Taylor Swift today. Let's hear a little bit more.
When I walk in the room, I can still make the whole place shimmer.
So that's going to end it for us today. My thanks to Abby Marshall and Connor Morris from IdeaStream Public Media and State House News Bureau Chief Karen Kassler. To get the last word on today's topic, send an email to soi@ideastream.org. I'm sorry, ideastream.org. We're on Twitter at Sound of Ideas. I'm Marlene Harris-Taylor, and thank you for listening.
Sapphire tears on my face, sadness became sky. But some guy said my aura's moonstone just 'cause he was high. And we're dancing all night, and you can try to change my mind, but you might have to wait in line. What's a girl gonna do? A diamond's gotta shine.